I'm Charles Wiley. I'm with the Ames Speakers Bureau, and I just want to briefly welcome you to what I think may turn out to be accuracy in media's greatest contribution to the American scene, which is to straighten out the history of that sad chapter called Vietnam, to establish truth and return this nation's honor to it. And I think that in view of the short time that we had for the scheduling of this, because we are trying to do a film on the subject and we had a tight schedule and we had to call this conference rather quickly if we were to meet that schedule, I thought that the turnout was incredible, and it is just a tribute to the loyalty of AIM people, namely you, and that, of course, is the lifeblood of this organization, is the loyal supporters, and if the loyal supporters are the blood, then the heart of this thing is Reed Irvine. Reed didn't want to be introduced. He said, we don't have time to introduce him. Everybody knows who he is, and anyhow, there's a biography of him in the program. But I just wanted to point out some things that you don't know. You do know, of course, that he's taken on the David and Goliath fight when very few people were even aware that there was a war to be fought. And he's done it by unbelievable dogged determination, and only those people who know him know how he has hung in when very, very few people would have hung in. He won't let them get away. He continues the fight. He is an inspiration to those people who think you can't fight City Hall. He started from a standing start, and he's helped turn things around. He's worked like hell. He's had dogged determination. He's stayed the course, and he's protecting freedom of the press and the survival of our democracy. Reed Irvine.
Thank you, Charlie. I want to welcome all of you here to a conference, a very important conference, which was called primarily to assemble a group of experts who would discuss the PBS film, Vietnam, and television history. As Charlie said, we will be doing interviews, televising or taping interviews with these experts during their stay here in Washington. These interviews will be used in our program, our documentary, which we are hoping to have done in September, and we hope will be available for distribution on television stations throughout the country as a critique, as a reply to that $5.5 million series, which was financed, at least half of it, with public money. Now, one of the things that we are confronted with, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have gotten this project started with a $30,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. The people who put on the PBS series got a $1.2 million grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. We are, again, very much in a David versus Goliath situation. We're trying to answer their $5.5 million program with something that is obviously going to cost a lot less. However, we are hoping that we will be able to put a lot more than $30,000 into it. We are turning, people have said, where are you going to get the rest of the money? And we'd like to have about $200,000 to put this project off properly. And I said, well, we're going to count on the members of Accuracy and Media to come through. We have approximately 40,000 members. If each of them contributed only $5, we would have $200,000. That doesn't seem to be an impossible thing, because we do have an extraordinary group of people who are supportive of AIM. But I ask you who are here today, there is a coupon in the back of your program, and if you feel inclined to help us get the ball rolling, to help us, it's already rolling, but to help us get it rolling faster and to completion, I urge you to make a special contribution, if you can afford it, to assist in this very worthwhile project. You know, Herbert Aptheker, the theoretician of the Communist Party of the USA, once said that history must be rewritten through Marxist eyes. And if the Marxists were writing the history of Vietnam, of the Vietnam War, I suggest that many of the things that we saw in the PBS series would have been exactly what they themselves would have done. I have a list of some 15 or 16. I'm not going to give them all here this morning, but I'll just give a few. They would certainly have wanted to show that the Vietnam War was a noble war. Now, President Reagan said it was a noble war, and he was criticized for it. But the Marxists, they would say that it was a noble war. That is noble for the communists. Those in North Vietnam and the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. They would want to portray them as dedicated, selfless nationalists who fought first the French and the Americans to secure the independence of their country, to end colonialism, and to defeat American imperialism. And that, I submit, was one of the messages that came through in the PBS series. They would want to show that after defeating the French, the nationalists under the leadership of the great charismatic Ho Chi Minh were cheated out of control of all Vietnam by the perfidy of the United States and its puppet, the cruel, dictatorial, autocratic Ngo Dinh Diem. They would say that they were promised elections, which they were sure to win, but the Diem welched on that promise and the Americans supported him. Again, the message that comes through. They would want to portray the communist takeover in the North in 1954 as liberation, while the American puppet, Ngo Dinh Diem, continued to subject the South to the imperialist rule of the foreigner. There was in the program, one of the programs, one of the 13 programs was titled America's Mandarin, that is, America's puppet, Ngo Dinh Diem. And finally, finally, there are many things I could say that were finally, but just as another illustration, they would want to show that Ho Chi Minh, moved by the persecution of his followers under Diem, responded to the pleas of his followers and admirers in the South, and somewhat reluctantly decided to give them the military and assistance, logistical assistance, that they needed to secure their liberation. Again, that was the message that came through to me in this program. Now, ladies and gentlemen, one important justification for the study of history is that it helps us avoid the repetition of past mistakes. As Santayana said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Public Broadcasting Service's 13-part television history of Vietnam, which was produced at a cost of $5.5 million, much of it from public funds, has aroused passionate criticism from Vietnam veterans, Vietnamese refugees, scholars, and journalists. One of the criticisms is that it is such a badly flawed history of the Vietnam War and those who participated in it, that it is more likely to lead us to make serious mistakes in the future than to avoid them. The series rightly portrays the tragic consequences of the victory of communism in Vietnam for the inhabitants of Indochina. Let's give them credit for that. It tells us that in Cambodia, perhaps a third of the entire population perished in the 3.5 years of the rule of the murderous communist Pol Pot. It describes the repression and the misery that caused an estimated 2 million Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians to flee their countries at the risk of their lives, a tragic exodus unprecedented in the history of those lands. The Vietnamese say they endured Chinese rule, French rule, Japanese rule and oppression, famine during that period of the Japanese rule, the war, the long war, under the French, and thousands and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese did not flee their native land. Only when they were, quote, liberated by the communists, did the people flee en masse. The series fails to instruct us in the mistakes that were instrumental in bringing about this horrendous human tragedy. It provides no useful guidance to the course that we should follow to prevent other countries from being engulfed by the scourge of communism. It doesn't explain how it happened that a poor, backward, underdeveloped country, languishing in the grip of the failed system of totalitarian communism, succeeded in prevailing over the richest, most powerful nation in the world. Nor does it explain why this failed system is steadily expanding its dominion, eroding the territory of the free world. Now, Vietnam was not lost because the communists had better soldiers, better weapons, or better military tactics and strategy. Vietnam was lost on the battlefield of words and ideas, and the PBS television history of Vietnam fails to teach that important lesson. And what is worse, it repeats and even amplifies the verbal and visual ammunition that had proven so successful during the war in sapping the will of the American people and their government to accomplish what they had spent 57,000 American lives and billions of dollars of treasure to achieve. In so doing, it teaches us not how to avoid our past errors, but encourages us to repeat them. On balance, it comes out on the side of those who, when they cry, "No more Vietnams," do not mean no more surrender of free world territory, but rather no more use of American military might to resist the spread of the cancer of communism. The meaning of "no more Vietnams" is an invitation to the Soviets to carry out their plans for subversion and aggression without hinder. Properly analyzed, the PBS series can teach us a great deal about communist propaganda and disinformation and how it succeeded in penetrating our mass media during the war. We have assembled at this conference a number of men who had personal knowledge of the Vietnam War and others who have studied and pondered the lessons to be learned from it in a scholarly way. Our task is to discuss the PBS history, to analyze its weaknesses and its strengths, and we hope that at the end of these 2 days, we will have called attention to most of the serious errors of fact, the inexcusable omissions, and the more offensive, misleading juxtapositions. I hope that we will end in agreement on some of the more important lessons that we and future generations must learn from the tragic history of Vietnam. And most of all, I hope that we might come away with a few rays of hope for the people of Indochina, of Afghanistan, of Nicaragua, of Cuba, and indeed of China and the Soviet Union themselves. It is nowhere writ that the people in these countries must be enslaved in perpetuity. If we can be defeated by the power of communism's outdated, outmoded, and outlandish ideas, simply because they have developed a more effective and powerful distribution system for those ideas, I think there's room for hope. Our ideas, which have proven their superiority in production, distribution, and the enhancement of the quality of life of millions of people the world over, will triumph if we will only put more effort, more money, and more talent into their dissemination. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have on our program some of those this morning who participated in the Vietnam War had a very personal and some very difficult experiences. And I think one of the worst parts of the PBS series was their treatment of our prisoners of war. And we have today two distinguished prisoners of war. We're not going to spend a lot of time because we're going to have to move fast, and we want to give the maximum time to our speakers, not talking about them and who they are, and that's why their biographies are printed in the program in brief. But I want to pay tribute to these men. John McCain, who was shot down, Navy pilot, shot down in 1967, spent 6 years in a Hanoi prison camp, and who was, of course, the son of Admiral McCain, was given special treatment because, I think, of his relationship, not specially kind treatment, but specially cruel treatment because of who he was. But he survived, and he's come back to tell his story, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from John, who is now a U.S. congressman. And we also have Captain Red McDaniel, president of the American Defense Foundation, Spent 27 years in the Navy, was shot down in 1967 while on his 81st combat mission, and was held prisoner until March 73. On his return, he was awarded the Navy Cross for bravery. These gentlemen are going to discuss their experiences and their view of how the PBS program treated our POWs. I think we'll start first with Congressman McCain. John?
Thank you very much, Reed, and I'm very glad to be here. And I, according to protocol, my friend Red should have gone first. He's senior to me, and I also know that Red would like to tell you that dispel any impressions you might have of us being heroes. Remember that it takes no talent whatsoever to get shot down. In fact, no astronaut tests or anything of that nature. In fact, if I could, I'd just. In fact, if you've been reading the Washington Post lately. I hope you haven't. There's a lot of stories about waste and mismanagement in defense spending. I'd like to just tell you an example of that, that I am a living example of that, and that is that when I was in a squadron, in fact, Red and I were in the same squadron for a long period of time in the early 60s, and I was the only bachelor in the squadron. And once every few months, a quota would come in for someone to go to escape and evasion school, which, as you know, is how to escape or evade in case you're shot down. And being the only bachelor in the squadron, they'd always send McCain, since the married guys didn't want to go. And so I went to 6 escape and evasion schools. And I went to one in Germany. I went to one up in Alaska. I went to all the country. When I was shot down, I was directly over the city of Hanoi. Destroyed a surface-to-air missile with my own airplane. McNamara approved of that kind of activities, and I went down in a lake right in the center of the city of Hanoi, and it was a 5-minute ride to the prison. Now, there's an example of waste of your defense dollars, if there ever was such a thing. I believe that that in PBS and throughout the war, the whole POW issue was tremendously distorted, and the American people still, in many ways, because of that kind of propaganda that was put out, still have a distorted opinion. In fact, many people still approach me and Red and my friends and say, well, you look so normal. You know, of course, being a member of Congress belies that. But the fact is, we're not vegetables. The majority of us did not cooperate. The overwhelming majority of us, with very few exceptions, I think wrote a chapter that all Americans can be immensely proud because of the conditions under which many of us, beginning with our friend Everett Alvarez and others, who showed immense strength, immense courage. And that message still has never gotten across to the American people. Why? One reason is because when Ramsey Clark, Jane Fonda, the list goes on and on, the litany of them, would come to Hanoi, they would always see the same 7 or 8 individuals who would tell them how wonderful their treatment was, how they wanted the United States to stop the war, how important and terrible it was what the United States was doing in Indochina. And yet never once did I hear a query before, during, or since as to why the media people and the others who came and visited Hanoi only saw the same people. There was some 335 of us there, and yet it was always the same 7 or 8 people, generally speaking, with which they visited. Nor, I wonder why the media people who visited didn't get to go see some of the camps. Why weren't they allowed to meet with groups of them? Why weren't they allowed to visit the numerous camps that our government knew and had told them were around Hanoi? Instead, they always went to one place. They always saw the same people. Let me just give you a small example of the kind of, but first of all, let me begin by saying the reason why prisoners were taken was simply for and solely for propaganda reasons. Don't anybody believe that we were taken prisoner because somehow, and kept alive because somehow they wanted to extend some humane and lenient hand to those of us who were shot down. Ho Chi Minh made it very clear many times that the POWs were a major bargaining chip at the negotiating table, and indeed they were. As the war went on and on, it became apparent that many Americans were willing to sell out our entire effort in Indochina in exchange for the return of the POWs, which was not why we went there. And those of us who were there did not want to come home under those circumstances. In fact, our slogan that we would tap to each other on the walls and say to each other if we ever had the opportunity and repeat time and time again, home with honor, home with honor. Home with honor did not mean the United States selling out Indochina in exchange for our return. I was captured in 1967, as Reed mentioned. I was very badly injured. I was taken to a cell, left on the floor of a cell for a long period of time, about 5 days. I was in a stretcher in my underwear with a blanket over me. The Vietnamese the word escapes me. Their policy was that there was no medical treatment given to anyone who refused to give military information. Because I refused to give military information, I laid on the floor of this cell. Finally, on the morning of the fourth day, a Vietnamese guard came in with another guard, pulled up the blanket that was over me. I looked, and my knee was about the size and shape and color of a football. And so I knew that I was in rather serious condition. I told the guard to get the officer. The officer came to my cell with one of Red's and my favorite people, a guy we called Zorba, the camp doctor. Camp Dr. Zorba, as far as I know, knew two words, exercise, because when he would come to your room and ask how you were, you'd say, well, not so good. He'd say, exercise. I mean, you should exercise. And how you. And he knew those. That was one word, how you. But he came in with the guard, with the officer, took my pulse, shook his head, and said something in Vietnamese. And the officer said, no, it's too late. And I said, look, take me to the hospital. I'll get well. He said, no, it's too late, too late. They walked out, and about 4 hours later came back in the cell, and the guard, our friend the bug, said, your father is a big admiral. And I said, my father's the biggest admiral in the whole Navy. And so he said, now we take you to the hospital, and they took me to the hospital. Just one story for you. I was in the hospital. I was not well treated, naturally, as you can imagine. Conditions were very bad, and I'm not being critical of the Vietnamese for that. The conditions in their hospitals were not good. One day, they came into my cell, took me out of the dirty, filthy cell which I had been kept, and took me into another room, which was a large room, had three hospital beds in it, bright lights. There was a little tray with tea and cookies next to it. And I said, what's going on? They said, oh, we've decided to improve your treatment. I said, well, that's very nice. I was a little stupid. Then, about a half an hour later, a Frenchman comes in with a cameraman, a French guy, and he starts filming. And he said, what's your name? I told him my name. He said, where are you from? And I told him where I was from. And the officer in the background said, tell him you want to stop the war. Tell him you want to stop the war. And I didn't say anything. And the Frenchman said, did you have anything else to say? And I said, no. And the guy in the back said, tell him you want to stop the war. And I didn't say anything. Frenchman left, the guard came over, punched me a few times, and back to my old room I went. That was my first experience with manipulation by the media. Time after time, they used us as propaganda vehicles. They were very successful in doing so, and I don't think anybody should deny that. They were able to, through the use of early releases, send a few men home who would praise the Vietnamese for their treatment of them. They were able to orchestrate various little propaganda shows, like at Christmas time and others, which gave an entirely false impression as to the conditions under which we live. I would like to stop and give Red a chance here now to speak. He is one of my heroes because I can tell you he underwent a lot more difficult times than I did. I'd also like to pause and thank you, Reed, for having this very important meeting, because unless we learn these lessons, we're going to learn them all over again in Central America. And that's why I think this meeting is so important. And I thank you very much.
Good. Thank you, John, for those words. Reed, I want to thank you, too, for your part in trying to maintain an accurate, fair, balanced media, because I believe a greater threat to this nation, even greater than the Soviet Union, is national media bias. On November 1st, 1968, we stopped the bombing of North Vietnam for one reason. Then President Johnson stopped it to have impact on an election in this country between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. To me, that marked a military decline, the beginning of military decline in this country. But prior to that, we had dug in our cells, which about 7 by 9 feet, foxholes, And when the bombers would come 10, 12 times per day, we were forced to get out of our beds or down into that foxhole, and sometimes the foxholes would fill with water. But when the bombing stopped, they had us fill those foxholes in to keep us from tunneling out, prevent escape. And on the day that had one cellmate, we covered our hole with about 15 wheelbarrows of dirt. It worked to allow that to sit for about 2 weeks, settle, and then they'd put 8 inches of concrete over that. And when they did, put us in that evening in the freshly filled foxhole, my cellmate had a good sense of humor. He built a little cross about that square, stuck it down into that foxhole. And when the guard came in to make sure that we were there, to make sure we had nothing we weren't supposed to have, he saw that cross. He was very puzzled. He didn't know what it meant, but he knew it shouldn't be there. So he said, "No good, take out." Raised his voice. He said, "No good, take out." He saw that we weren't going to respond, so he went over to reach down and pick that cross up. And when he did, my cellmate put his hands on his chin, a very loud voice said, "Boom, boom." Well, the guard wasn't sure what that meant, but he wasn't taking any chances. So he left. And we'd had the same guard for about two years. We knew his every habit, and we knew he'd be back in about 15 minutes to try again. While he was gone, my cellmate took a string, dug a little trench, tied the string to the end of the cross, covered it with dirt, ran the string up onto our board bed where he'd be sitting when he came back. And the guard, sure enough, about 20 minutes later came back, yelling again, "No good, take out." So he saw that we weren't going to respond, so he went over. He wasn't going to pick it up this time. He drew his right leg back to kick it. And when he did, my cellmate pulled the string, the cross moved, the guard left, has not been seen or heard from since. Vietnam was a tragic war, a divisive war. But the tragedy, though, was not in losing South Vietnam. The tragedy was that we sent 3 million of our finest young men to fight a no-win war. Committed to those 3 million men, but never committed to the heart of the nation. The media destroyed our resolve to tough it out. We were accused of bombing hospitals, schools. In my 81 missions, I have taken bombs out of North Vietnam because I could not find the target. We could have destroyed Vietnam on any Monday afternoon by bombing their dikes, which we never did. In turn, we destroyed 3 million people. A very divisive war. But as we get away from Vietnam, we're taking a new perspective, a new look at Vietnam. And I believe history will show that by hanging there as we did those 12 years, we drove a wedge between the Chinese and the Vietnamese. I'm not sure where that's going to lead, but if we're going to hold the Russian bear at bay, it's going to take the Chinese to do it. In 1966, the North Vietnamese needed propaganda statements for an international media event, Bertrand Russell. They needed some statements. They were not able to get them through coercion, so they started torturing prisoners to get those statements. And every person has a breaking point. It might take one day, 1 week, 1 month, or in two cases, almost a decade. The enemy had the means, and they used it. So they got the propaganda statements, took them to Sweden for the trials, and from that time on, they tortured every American up until 1970 when the torture stopped. Very brutal torture. In 1969, we had one of three escape attempts, all unsuccessful. The plan was to go out of the overhead of the building that we were housed in, down the 18-foot wall, over a 22-foot wall that surrounded the camp, to get into the Red River and float 110 miles to the coast through the second major city, Haiphong. Once we got to the coast, the plan was to swim 12 miles out into the ocean, hoping a Navy ship would be there to pick us up. To be done without food, without water, a desperate attempt, but we were desperate men. We had the second of three attempts, May 10th, 1969. I was the main communications link. I was not one of the escapees because the average Vietnamese is about 5'2". He has black hair. And I didn't fit into that mold, but I was the main communications link. And 20 men were tortured very brutally. One of the escapees who were caught the next day was brought back to camp. Major Ed Atterbury was tortured to death. And we think 30 of 40 of our cellmates were tortured to death in our 7, 8, in two cases, 9 years there. But I went up at the end of 30 days in an impossible situation. I went up to confirm all that had been told under heavy torture, because when men are tortured, they talk. I went up for 2 weeks. I went 7 days, 7 nights without sleep. I was kneeling on pitted concrete. With my arms tied over my head, I sustained a compound fractured left arm, which I still can't straighten. I was beaten daily with a fan belt about 50 times. I underwent 3 hours of electric shock treatment, again for information I did not possess, because if I'd had it, I would have given it willingly. I went from 160 pounds down to about 110 pounds, but they won't let you die. They back off, give you medicine to come back later for more torture. A very brutal system. The thing that illustrated that system to me was that my first impression of that prison was a concrete slab. On one end would be leg irons, another iron bar curved to go over your ankles at night. At the head would be manacles, where our wrists would be padlocked sometimes at night. In between the leg irons and the manacles, though, would be an imprint of a body in that concrete slab, about 5'2", the average height of a Vietnamese. That imprint would be years in the making, blood, sweat, and tears. But that illustrated to me the brutality of the communist system. It's tough. It's harsh. It is not an alternative to what we have in this country. Jane Fonda is not one of my favorite people, because when Jane Fonda came to Hanoi, we were tortured to go downtown to meet with her. The 7 or 8 that John mentioned, always the same 7 or 8, went downtown to meet with Jane Fonda. And I had a cellmate once who was tortured for 7 days and 7 nights without sleep until he weakened to go downtown to meet with the U.S. delegation for another media event. He got downtown, he refused to answer a couple of questions because we're very anti-American. And when he did, the American citizen, Sandra Smith, looked at the Vietnamese officer who escorted him downtown and said, "This young man has a bad attitude." My cellmate was brought back to camp and tortured because of that event. Well, freedom of speech is what it's all about. But I'm not sure that freedom extends to the heartland of the enemy in time of war. Again, media. The series in PBS was a very subtle message, I thought. I thought the first 4 chapters were fairly well balanced, the first 4 sessions. But then you got into the 5th session. And to give you a little history, the way that started, Wilfred Bruchette, an Australian journalist, lived in Hanoi while John and I were in prison, allied with the Vietnamese. He went with Martin Smith, an English journalist, into Hanoi to see Bo Nguyen Giap, their military leader, Le Wan, and that's how the PBS series started. Very unfair, very inaccurate, and a disservice to the American people, because I believe Vietnam to be the right war, in the right place, but fought in the wrong manner. Since John and I came home in 1973, 11 nations have gone under. Over 100 million people are now under communist domination. A real tragedy. Richard Nixon, who I met with about a month ago, had an hour with him, is writing a book, No More Vietnams. He's using that title to hook the liberals, to get them to read it. It's going to be no holds barred, no footnotes, just what he saw in Vietnam. And I think if you've read his book, Real Peace, and you probably haven't because he only printed 1,000 copies, it's the most compact, succinct message on where we're headed in this country. Because he believes, as I do, the only way to have peace in this country is to be strong militarily. And I'd rather be strong and never need it than the other way around. That lengthening shadow of communism that we hear so much about is very real. We can't wish it away. We can't pray it away. It's something we must feel squarely. They've neutralized Eastern Europe, Africa, now in Central and South America. You say, well, is that another Vietnam? Absolutely not, because Vietnam was 10,000 miles away. El Salvador is closer to Houston, Texas than Houston is to our capital, 1,188 miles. In Vietnam, when it fell in 75, 10% of the South Vietnamese put to sea in a desperate dash for freedom to cross 1,000 miles of ocean to reach Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, desperately hoping for freedom. If we lose El Salvador, 100 million people live between there and the border. So it's our job to make sure the media is accurate and biased, which they are not And I say media, I mean national media from the Northeast Corridor. A study I saw said 82% of the people who supported, who voted in 1972, they're involved in the media, voted for George McGovern. And when the enemy started campaigning for George McGovern, I knew he couldn't be all good. 75% of the national media believe in homosexual rights. Well, those two things don't bother me too much, but this one does. The third one, only 1 in 10 of the national media attend church, giving them the same moral base that godless Russia has. And I believe that disinformation, if we don't reverse some of the trends, will destroy this great country. I'm involved in an effort which will support Reed Irvine's effort, the American Defense Foundation. We're embarked on trying to register 1.5 military people who don't vote. A federal law says every military person will be hand-carried a federal postcard application requesting an absentee ballot. 90% of the military vote absentee ballot, and we're exercising that federal law. The Navy today is 70% registered. The Air Force is about 65 or 70% registered. The Army is a little behind, but coming on strong. Because in 1980, according to a RAND Corporation survey, 182,000 military people couldn't vote because they could not get their absentee ballots. 34 of our states do not meet the 35-day standard that the Department of Justice says is needed to get a request a ballot, get it there, and get it back to be counted. 34 states. Pennsylvania charges their servicemen taxes, but they mail out their absentee ballot 11 to 14 days prior to the election, disenfranchising their servicemen. You're going to see a massive turnout in 1984 because I believe men who fight and sometimes die, to vote is not just a right, it's a responsibility. To vote for the politicians who send them into those combat areas. I want to close and let you ask some questions, but first I want to say this. To be born free as we are in this country is an accident. To live free, though, is a responsibility. And to die free is an obligation. God bless you.
Thank you, John and Red. We have about 15 minutes for questions, and there is a microphone. If you have a question, please come to the mic and direct your question to the speaker that you wish to ask it of. I might start first, gentlemen, by noting that in the PBS, to get down to the PBS series specifically, they did interview Robinson Risner. What did you think about the juxtaposition? I said in my remarks that we were going to talk about the misleading juxtapositions. The juxtaposition that we saw in the PBS series was, first of all, talking about the bombing by the Americans, raining down death and terror on the people of Vietnam and the communists. Then we had our prisoners of war, the men, most of them were pilots who had been engaging in this combat. We had Robinson Risner discussing a little bit about the treatment that they received, nothing like the graphic detail that you've heard this morning. And then we next had an account of the torture of a Viet Cong by the South Vietnamese, I think, as I recall, perhaps with an American standing by. I'd like to get your comments on what you think the message of that particular juxtaposition was.
Reed, I think that the...
Not working, John.
It's... If I could address the bombing issue as quickly as possible. As Red said, there's no doubt that we could have
concluded that war in a very short period of time. I'll never forget the first target that I was assigned in North Vietnam to bomb. I went up and got the readout that we used to receive on what the target was and all about, and I noticed with some interest that it had been bombed 27 times before. Well, the reason for that, and it was a pile of concrete. On the same picture, about 100 yards away, was a bridge going over a rather small river. The military barracks, which was a pile of concrete by this time, was on the approved target list. The bridge was not, and many of you may or may not remember, every single target that we could hit had to be approved by the White House, not by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not by our commanding officer on the carrier or the admirals involved. Example number two, one day in August of 1967, we were striking some targets outside Haiphong. We were forbidden to strike or drop a bomb inside the city of Haiphong at that time. The number three man in the formation that I was flying in, surface-to-air missile came, blew him out of the sky. The number four man rolled in and bombed the anti-aircraft position from which that missile came, which happened to be in downtown Haiphong. We returned to the ship. The officer, the pilot who had dropped those bombs, was immediately reprimanded and grounded by the commanding officer, and only through the intervention of the admiral on board was he allowed to fly again. This is the kind of restrictions that we had over our bombing. We didn't bomb any schools, we didn't bomb any hospitals, and we only bombed those areas that were, quote, military targets. And in the Christmas of 1972, we proved that with a B-52 bombing that they could bring the Vietnamese to their knees, which they did. After the first couple of nights of B-52 bombing, asked the B-52 pilots, it was milk runs, there was no opposition. They totally destroyed their command and communications, they totally destroyed their SAM sites, and there was no resistance whatsoever remaining. We could have done that in 1965. As far as the juxtaposition that Reed is speaking of, yeah, I think it's an outrage, because there's a major difference here. The Vietnamese had a calculated policy of mistreatment and torture in order to further their war efforts. That is, to me, a dramatic difference between the isolated incidents, which took place sometimes on the part of American soldiers in the heat of battle, and on the Vietnamese as far as incidents of torture is concerned. There's a great deal of difference between, as far as I'm concerned, between individual acts which were not countenanced by the United States government and calculated long-term program of torture and mistreatment, which was a policy of the North Vietnamese government.
People like Robbie Reisner. Robbie was a national hero before he went to Vietnam. He was on the cover of Time magazine, received the first Air Force Cross. Like John McCain, John was very prominent there because of his father's position. And the enemy used that, pressured those men. You'll never know the pressures that people like John and Robbie Reisner had. Robbie Reisner told me once there, he said, if they'd asked me to kill my mother, I would have. But Robbie Reisner is a great leader. And he's never met a person he didn't touch. So what I'm really saying is the enemy used, because they knew through national media they could gain, divide this nation, the same as the communists tried to do. They tried to divide America and conquer the world. And they tried to do that through media. The best thing that could happen to prisoners of war, if there were an international law that no media could be used, there would be no torture of POWs, because we were there for propaganda purposes, and that's why they nurtured us. Yes, sir.
I have a question for both of you, but may I start with your question, Captain? Yes, I'm John Hemingway. I'm an attorney, former State Department, former past president of the American Foreign Service Association. I wouldn't take necessarily President Nixon's injunction that we ought to be prepared for war to keep the peace and to protect freedom. I think George Washington made essentially that point a couple hundred years earlier. But I was wondering why, in your support of that point, which I certainly agree with, and I think the nation owes you men and officers and men like you a great debt of honor. You have served your country much better than most Americans ever will. Struck me that in support of Mr. Nixon, you also seemed to support, by implication, the people around Nixon, which included Henry Kissinger. Now, if you're going to have a well-oiled military machine that's capable of protecting your liberty, and then you have a Secretary of State who'll hand that liberty on a silver platter over a signature that isn't worth the powder to blow it to hell, your military machine hasn't done a thing for you, has it? That's a statement couched in an interrogatory form.